Thank you, Jim, and what a joy, what a delight. I want to say again, what a thrill it has been for me to have been with you. I've told you on previous occasions that when I was in intensive care back in '03, January of '03, and they began to ask me questions, kind of checking my memory, I was in error on some things. I told them that all four of my grandparents were still living, and that wasn't correct. They asked me where I lived and what I did for a living, and I said, I live in Athens, Alabama, and I'm the minister at the Bethel Church of Christ. And they told me later that when there is a traumatic brain injury like the one I had, only the nearest and dearest of memories survive. And you needed to know that. That you rank right up there with my grandparents, and what a thrill it has been for us to be with you this week. If you have your Bibles, be turning with me to the fourth chapter of the book of John. And I'm aware of the fact that there are several of us in this room that have been to workshops and seminars and have studied church growth. And there aren't any simple answers. I'm aware of the fact I can't fool you. I had a preacher buddy of mine that used to teach a little children's class before Sunday night service. And he was up teaching all the little bitty kids. And he was talking with them about Noah's Ark. And he was emphasizing to them that God took two of every kind. And he got the kids to enumerate two what? Well, two elephants and two giraffes and two lions and tigers and bears, oh my. And they just named all kinds of things. Everything they could think. Two of this, two of that. And then the teacher asked the little kids, what do you think they did on the ark while it was floating on all that water? And one child said, well, I guess they talked a lot and maybe they talked to God and they prayed and they had worship. And the teacher said, well, what do you think they did for fun? Well, maybe they played games. And the teacher said, I wonder if out there on all that water they went fishing. And one little boy said, they didn't do much fishing if they only had two worms. Well, he couldn't fool them and I can't fool you. John chapter 4, in my judgment, is one of the most impressive, powerful passages in all of the Bible when it comes to bringing people to Jesus. And this is a Wednesday night crowd. And I know I'm talking to folks who care very much about the lost in your family, about the lost in this community. And I say again, this is one of the most meaningful, applicable chapters anywhere. Because what's happened is this. Jesus and his disciples have certain encounters there. And Jesus says in verse 35, lift up your eyes and look. And you've heard this passage before. Many of you could quote it from memory. He says, look up, the fields are white unto harvest. Now, I'm impressed, really, with a number of things, one of which is the background to this story. As we get into this, you need to understand with me tonight that there are few things in this life that are any more tragic than a missed opportunity. I'm a student of the Civil War. Or as we called it in my family, the War of Northern Aggression. My great-great-grandfather fell at Gettysburg and was captured and spent the rest of the war in a prisoner of war camp. And one of the interesting things about Gettysburg is one of our finest cavalry generals, a fellow named Jeb Stuart, was out circling around, riding around, scouting, and missed the whole battle. He missed an opportunity. And you say, oh, preacher, that happened years and years and years ago. What difference does it really make, especially at this point in history? Well, that is the point, that history is littered with the tragedy of missed opportunity. We had a man at our congregation at Brainerd in Chattanooga when I was a teenager. And he told a bunch of us one time, his name was Overton Smith, and he told us about a business opportunity that he had back in the 1920s. A fellow approached him to invest in building airplanes. And he told us he didn't think it'd get off the ground. And so he declined, and he said, by the way, kids, guess what that guy's name was? McDonald. And Brother Smith turned him down, and he went to a fellow named Douglas. Missed opportunities. The same thing is true in our family. Many of you have very kindly asked about my boys. And my baby will be 33 this year. I don't know how that happened. My oldest is pushing 40. I don't know how that happened. My middle son that was born when we lived here will be 36. And I don't need to tell you of the missed opportunities that we had that have slipped by. And the same thing that happens in business, the same thing that happens in the family, happens in the church. And the Bible kind of punches away at it. Jesus said, what shall it profit? And there's the bottom line in business, right? What shall it profit a man if he should gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Well, Lord, what difference does it make? Well, think about it. He's using what we call a hyperbole, an exaggeration for effect. That if it were possible to gain the whole world, and that's not possible, but just suppose it was, and lose your own soul, what's it profited? And you know the answer, and so do I. The answer is nothing. What difference does it make? Everything. And he's the loser. I read a story years ago about a man, an old man walking down the beach. He had retired down on the coast. And he's walking along the beach, and ahead of him, he noticed a young man reaching down and picking up starfish and that had washed up on the shore and was flinging them back out into the sea. And he caught up with the young man, and he asked him what he was doing. And he said, well, these starfish are stranded, and they're going to die in the sun if I don't throw them back out in the ocean. And the old man said, well, fella, this beach goes on for miles. And there's probably millions of starfish. You think you're really going to make a difference? And the young fella held up one starfish. He said, it makes a difference to this one. And the same thing is true in your life and in mine. And I can't help but think that that's what Jesus was thinking, or at least thinking along these lines in John chapter 4. And you need to know that the whole thing comes about as a result of the failure of the disciples in dealing with the Samaritan woman. Here's a human being. She has a never dying eternal soul. She has hurts and feelings and disappointments and desires and concerns. And Jesus wanted his disciples more than anything else to be a lot more concerned about people than they were issues. And so he sat at Jacob's well, and the disciples went to Sychar to buy food. And as they were going up the hill, this woman was going down the hill to the well to draw water. And if you know anything about the geography, if you know anything about the terrain, then these disciples came very close to that woman. So close that somebody had to step aside for the other to get by. Surely it was close enough to speak, but they didn't even see her. Here's an opportunity for human contact. In speech, they taught us about emphatic communication. And it happens to us all the time. You're coming in and out of a door at a store or an office or anything, and you hear somebody and you kind of close contact. Hey, how you doing? Howdy. Hello. And, or as the kids say, what's up? And it's just acknowledging that other person as a human being, and they don't even do that. They pay her absolutely no attention. And she comes to the well, and Jesus hears her story. Jesus sees her for who she really is. A sinner. An adulterous sinner. Had five husbands. But he saw her as a soul. And this is what life in Jesus is all about. Giving hope to the hopeless, seeking to save, Luke 19, verse 10, that which was lost. And if you look at your Bibles in John chapter 4 and verse 27, look at this. The disciples were shocked. One translation says marveled. What did they marvel at? That he talked with the woman. You didn't do that in the ancient Near East. She was a woman. She was a Samaritan woman. Strike three, she was an adulterous Samaritan woman. Now, I don't know who they thought you ought to reach out to with the gospel. Only the clean. Only those who have committed the minimum number of mistakes to suit us. But certainly not those who, in our human judgment, have committed the grossest of sins. Remember my definition of big sin and little sin? Big sin, the ones you commit. Little sin, the ones I commit. You like my definition? God doesn't either. But that seems to be our criteria by which we determine who do we want in this congregation and who do we not want. I was in a meeting a number of years ago, and I'm not going to tell you where it was. And I got up to preach one of my favorite sermons. It was about the lost sheep and the lost coin and the lost son from Luke 15. And I noticed back toward the back, a young man sat with his head down most of the time. I thought he was asleep there for a minute or two. But he'd raise his head up, and I preached my heart out, and it extended the invitation. I stepped down here, and the local preacher stepped over here. Last verse of the invitation song, the young man stepped out, walked down the aisle. I was the closest to him. I shook his hand, seated him right there. The invitation song was over, and the local preacher went around and sat with his family. I thought, that's all right. I know how to do this. I sat down. I said, buddy, you're going to have to tell me your name. He told me. I wrote it down. I said, why have you come? He said, Brother Bradley, I was raised in this church. I baptized right there in that baptistry. But you can't believe what I've done. I've embarrassed my family. I've embarrassed my name's been in the paper. I've embarrassed this church. He said, but I want to repent. I want to be forgiven. Did he come to the right place? Do your head like that. And so I got up and offered prayer. I didn't really even know anybody in the congregation well enough to call on him. I offered prayer on his behalf. I stepped down and went to the back. A local preacher again got up and thanked everybody for coming. Y'all come back tomorrow night. Call on song leader. Lead closing song. Some brother to lead closing prayer. Led to closing prayer, and I was standing at the back shaking hands, and something just told me to watch. I don't know. And after the closing prayer, I'm here to tell you, not one soul walked up to shake that boy's hand or hug his neck. Not one in an audience at least this big. And he stood there, and he stood there, and he stood there. And finally, he just bowed his head. And walked out. Well, one of the elders invited me to go to Shoney's and get a piece of pie and a cup of coffee. And y'all know me. I'm not about to turn that down. And so we went. We were talking. I said, tell me about this fellow that came forward. And that elder lit into him. Brother Bradley, he wasn't lying. You just can't believe what he's done. Every time we turned around, his name was in the paper. Every time we turned around, he'd done something. And he did. He shamed his family, and he shamed his church. And the elder went on and on and on talking about what this boy had done. I said, all right, I understand that. But he came forward, and he repented, and he asked to be forgiven. Elder said, you don't realize, Brother Bradley, what he's done. I said, I don't care what he's done. They like to throw us out of Shoney's. I said, you can send me home tonight for all I care. This church got a problem. This church is filled with a bunch of elder brothers. And that's why I say, just like in this case in John chapter, I don't know who they thought you ought to go looking out for. Now, in this case, back in John 4, they're shocked that he would speak to the woman, and then the woman left. And I don't know. I've often wondered, reading this story, I've often wondered why she left. I couldn't prove it if I had to, and I don't mean to put things into the text. I couldn't prove it to save my life. But I've often wondered if she didn't leave because of the rudeness of the disciples. But she left the water pot and she went to the city. And see, the sad thing about this is that these disciples were the religionists, if you will. But they didn't care about her. Not unlike that story that Jesus tells us about a Samaritan, and we call him good. Why do we call that fellow good? Because he stopped to help that wounded man on the side of the road. You remember that one down that road from Jerusalem to Jericho? And they stopped to help him. Don't let the other part of the story slip by. Who had passed him by on the other side? The religious people. The priest and the Levite. Well, again, back to John 4. Soon this lady was gone. And like a lot of preachers, they turned their attention to their lunch. And they urged Jesus to eat. And Jesus declined their invitation and said, in essence, let me tell you about food. He said, I have meat to eat that ye know not. And that kind of puzzled the disciples. They weren't aware that he was talking about spiritual food. They thought somebody from the city had come down and brought him food. Well, that's not going to happen. Highly unlikely that a Samaritan is going to feed a Jew. And so they start discussing this with one another. And Jesus informed them and us that the food he was talking about was not of the bacon and bean variety. Here it is now, folks. Bottom line, heart of the message. Don't miss this if you miss everything else. Jesus said, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and accomplish his work. Now, don't let that slip by. What he's saying, Lord, that the food I have to eat is to obey my Father, to seek and to save the lost, to reach out to those that are hurting, to touch lives, to give hope, to bring salvation. And I don't think the language there is accidental, because that expression food is used very often. For example, in Romans 16, in verse 18, Paul is talking about those who cause dissension and hindrances. And he says they, quote, serve their own belly. So that analogy is nothing new. What does food do? Well, it strengthens. It energizes. It sustains, especially preachers holding meetings, right, Jim? That's what it does. Is that what Jesus is talking about? Hear me tonight, please, I beg you. Jesus said that his food, my energy, my sustenance is to do the will of God. You feel that way? Do you feel that way? You see, what a lesson in evangelism if we can just lay hold of it. Because our mistake, in my judgment, is that to many, our food is just worship and fellowship in the assembly, you know, to kind of charge me up so I can go out and face the world. And that's fine. Don't misunderstand. But that's not all of it. In addition to that, our food, the very essence of our spiritual vitality, is doing the will of the Father as we reach out to seek and to save the lost. Great preacher friend of mine made this statement. I wrote it down. He said, "There is no more chance of your soul surviving without this food than there is that your body can survive physically without eating," end quote. And maybe that's the reason so many of us are sick spiritually. Maybe that's the reason so many are dying spiritually. Because there is no way for the child of God to live without it. Why do we come to worship or come to meetings or come to a workshop to get all charged up if we never share that influence? And the disciples had already missed one opportunity because of lunch. And Jesus doesn't want them to miss another. And so he says, "Lift up your eyes and look. The fields are white unto harvest." And I've told you repeatedly, as a little boy, I always thought he's talking about cotton. The fields are white unto harvest. Got to college and found out he's talking about grain, but the point is the same. The principle's the same. There are people everywhere that can be reached. And the real issue here is that the disciples thought that Samaria was the last place you'd go. Samaria is the last place that would be fruitful. At best, it's going to be some hard work involved with very, very minimal results. I can hear an accountant now saying, "This is not a good investment of our money, of our time." And I said all that to say this, hear me. There are people in your life, in your neighborhood, in your office, in your school, maybe in your own home, and you think about them that way. Wouldn't do any good to talk to them. There ain't no use trying. My favorite story of that is a couple that came to Hoover years and years and years ago. And she was a Christian, her husband was not, and he was a Jew from New York City. Now, man, you can't get no more lost than that, can you, Ken? He's a Jew from New York City. Sound like that TV commercial, doesn't it? New York City. Wouldn't do any good to talk to him, right? Wouldn't do any good to talk to him. Oh, I had one of the best studies I've ever had, Jim, because that guy had a working knowledge and understanding of the principle of sacrifice. Old Testament, say anything about that, brother? Just a little bit, right? And when I talked with him about Yom Kippur, I couldn't talk to that about some of y'all, but I could with him. And what a study. And he obeyed the gospel. What if I had listened to other people that said wouldn't do any good? And what I'm begging you tonight, say, I can get in my truck and go home this evening. I'm begging you tonight, when you leave this building tonight and when you get to your home tonight, and when you get in your neighborhood and your school and your community tomorrow, lift up your eyes and look. In Samaria, Lord? Yes. Now look what happened, verse 39. Many Samaritans believed. And from such an unlikely source, the testimony of this woman. Difficult? Sure. Reputation that was not what, right. But folks, if we are alert to the application of this passage, I want to head the list and say it kind of digs at me pretty hard, because our evangelism falls short when it comes to taking hold of opportunities. We mentioned this week about that line that starts in your home of unsaved people, 6-7 billion, and circles the globe. You remember that? And we live in a world where the majority of the world, think about this now, the majority of the world has never heard the name Jesus. They would not recognize it even if you said it in their own language. And if you were to quote to them, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him might not perish and have everlasting life," they wouldn't have a clue what you're talking about. More than half the world. Some of them in our own nation. Some of them in our own town. Some of them in our own home. Opportunities, and we haven't used it, and I don't know why. I say again, I've been going to lectureships and workshops for 40 years, and I can boil all of that down to one statement, and this is right out of GBV. That's the Gary Bradley version. And that is, unless we make soul winning our number one priority, then we are headed for a certain death as a fellowship. We are on a zero growth rate. One person says that if something doesn't change in the next 10 years, the United States Census Bureau will not even recognize us unless something changes. And that means we have to make soul winning our number one priority. Folks, listen to me. We are not at liberty. We do not have the discretion to establish our priority as to the work of the church. We're under marching orders. The participle in Matthew 28, as we go, when we go, where we go, as we're going, you're going. You may not be going overseas. You may not go into another continent, but you're going. You're going to a home. You're going to a neighborhood. You're going to a job. You're going to a school. You're going. And as you're going, take the gospel. I just wish we were as open to telling people about Jesus as we were Alabama and Auburn. Now, I've really gone to meddling, hadn't I? And that's one of the first questions that people ask when they are introduced to somebody new. Hi, where are you from? Where's home? What do you do? Are you Alabama or Auburn? I wish we were so free to be conversant with other people about Jesus as we are that. It's not a matter of whether or not we go. We're going. The issue is when and how. How are we going to go? And I beg people to use your talent to be involved in preaching the gospel. In one sense, sure, it may be giving of your money. Never shall forget being at the old building over on 72 back in the early 80s. One of our members walked in, and we were short on our budget, and he wanted to make up for it. He wrote a check. And I said, I don't know what to say. I really don't know what to say about your generosity. And he said, Gary, I've learned to live by Deuteronomy 8 and verse 18. I said, well, brother, God bless you. You are a blessing to this church. I couldn't wait for him to get out so I could look up Deuteronomy 8, 18. Ain't no need in y'all laughing. Some of y'all don't know what it says either. Deuteronomy 8 verse 18 says, don't forget the Lord, for it's he who gives you the power to get wealth. And that's the kind of dedication I'm talking about. That fella preached me a sermon, and it was a good one. He said, in essence, Gary, you've got some talents, and you are responsible for those talents. You are accountable to God. And he said, my talent is making money. It's a God-given talent, and I want to use it to his glory completely and fully. Friends, I don't understand how we can think that some of my talents are to be used to the glory of God and some of my talents are used for my fun and my enjoyment. It's all one package. And I'm begging you tonight that whatever talent you have, find the way to use it to lead others to Christ. Find the way to channel that talent to the glory of God. I heard about a fella at a plant who offered to carpool with all of his buddies, but he said, I tell you what, I'm going to do all the driving. We'll carpool, but I'll do all the driving and I'll buy all the gas. You think they jumped on that? He said, but now here's the catch. All week you're going to listen to cassette tapes of my preacher from church. Baptized for. Find the way to use your talent. I'm afraid that one of the reasons we haven't been as zealous in our willingness to share Christ with other people, one of the reasons we haven't been as compassionate toward other people as we need to be is because we think, oh, if it were my son, or if it were my husband, if it was my family. And yet because they're not in our own family, we think it's not real. It's always somebody else, and it's their problem. And it just doesn't make any difference to us when it's somebody else. Maybe we really don't believe that the person who's never accepted Christ through faithful obedience, maybe we really don't believe that the person who's never obeyed the gospel is lost. What does it take? What does it take? A number of years ago when I was an investigator with the DA's office, I had an unmarked car and police radios, and I heard them put out a wreck with injuries, and I happened to be close. And I got there first. I got there ahead of rescue. I got there ahead of the ambulance. And a young lady was in the front seat. A huge shard of glass had cut her throat. And her life's blood was pumping out with every beat of her heart. And there was nothing I could do. And I held her hand and she said, "Help me." And there was nothing I could do. And I watched her die. And I didn't know. I wondered if had she ever been obedient to the gospel. I found out later she had not. But you don't have to go through something like that in order for it to sink in. That's what this book, that's the message is. The wages of sin is death. For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And maybe we think God didn't mean that. Maybe we think that that person that's out of Christ is not really lost at all. And that somehow, some way, God's going to save everybody. If that's the case, he lied in this book. If that's the case, he lied in this book. And somehow he's changed his mind. And I wish everybody in this room had a burning desire for everybody that's lost. Because if you did, we'd turn the world upside down just like they did in the New Testament. Jesus did. And that's why I'm to have the mind of Christ. And if we felt the way he felt, and we could say like old Brother Whitefield said years ago, and I quote, "I'm willing to go to prison and to death for you, but I'm not willing to go to heaven without you." Do you feel that way? You see, if you're out of Christ, then we're here tonight for one reason. You. Because you see, if you were the only human to have ever existed in the history of man and the world, Jesus would have come to this earth and he would have died for you. And that's why we're here. And if you are in Christ and you need the strength and you need the courage, you need to think of what Jesus did for you. I have very few memories of my time in the hospital over a month, 2002 and 2003. Over a month in intensive care, I have very few memories of that, but I do remember one thing. I remember waking up and realizing that there were electrodes all over my chest. And I could look at a screen and there was a little light that was jumping. I thought, that's a good sign. And on one side, there was a bottle of clear liquid in a tube that ran down into my arm. And on the other arm, I looked and there's another plastic device with blood. And it's running down a tube into this arm. And I wondered, who gave that blood? Who was kind enough and generous enough to donate that blood that would save my life? Now you magnify that 10,000s times 10,000s and think about the blood that cannot save your life, but the blood that can save your soul. And that's the blood of Jesus. And that's why we beg people to obey it. And we beg people to be faithful And if you need the strength and the courage to share that with somebody else, then we invite you to come right now while we stand, while we sing.